From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Edward Villella was one of American ballet's male dance stars. Now he's artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. On today's Fresh Air, Villella tells us how he broke nine toes. Also, we meet Mubarak Awad, a Christian Palestinian who's working to find nonviolent solutions to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He runs the International Center for Nonviolence in Washington, D.C. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two reissues featuring violinist Joseph Sigeti. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg just got back from France. He'll fill us in on the language issue everyone in France is talking about. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has just voted 96 to nothing to denounce Senator David Duranberger for financial misconduct. Senate Ethics Chairman Howell Heflin read out the charges against the Minnesota Republican, including violating limits on speaking fees and gifts and converting a campaign contribution to his personal use. Duranberger was also disciplined for misleading the Senate on reimbursements he received while staying in his Minneapolis condominium. The committee said Duranberger should pay back more than $122,000 in fees he collected improperly. The House of Representatives has failed to override President Bush's veto of a measure that would have provided unpaid leave for workers with newborn babies or sick relatives. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
In floor debate today, several members of Congress on both sides of the aisle reminded President Bush of his campaign statements in support of leave for new mothers, saying that he went back on his word. Some Republicans warned their president that his veto would be perceived as anti-family and anti-woman. But 57 Democrats joined with 138 Republicans in upholding the president's decision, agreeing with his judgment that the government should not be in the business of mandating worker benefits. Despite the number of Democratic votes upholding the veto, Democrats hope to use the family leave issue to their advantage in the coming campaign when they expect to attract female voters on a raft of issues, including child care and abortion. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Secretary of State James Baker is flying to Asia today with hopes of closing down a 12-year-old civil war in Afghanistan. The fighting is supported by weapons from the U.S. and Soviet Union. Barry Schweid has more from the State Department.
Baker is first going to a meeting of Asian nations in Jakarta and then to Singapore. When he reaches Soviet Siberia a week from now, he hopes to find Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze ready to cut a deal over Afghanistan. The only remaining issue is whether the Soviets will cooperate in forcing President Najibullah to retreat to a figurehead role while the pro-Moscow government and the U.S.-backed Islam opposition work out terms of an election to choose a new government. State Department officials say the Soviets have been hinting for weeks that they're ready to deal. But the Kremlin's preoccupation with German unification and with a Communist Party Congress got in the way. Now, a settlement in Afghanistan is back at the top of Baker's agenda. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Prices on Wall Street closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points to close at 2,930.94. Advances led declines 3-2 in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 164 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Edward Villella is one of the most acclaimed American male dancers of our time. Dance critic Arlene Croce wrote, "The Villella repertory is the greatest corpus of ballets created for a male dancer in this century." Yet Villella broke a lot of the popular stereotypes of ballet dancers. He was a New Yorker from an Italian-American working-class family, and he was a college welterweight champion. Villella joined the New York City Ballet in 1957, and in 1960 became a principal dancer under George Balanchine's direction. Villella's TV appearances spread his fame beyond the dance world. Now Villella is carrying on the Balanchine tradition as the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. He sustained many injuries during his career as a dancer: back trouble, bad knees, 9 broken toes, and stress fractures on each shin. When he retired from dancing, he had a hip replacement. I asked him if he thought this was an uncommon number of injuries.
Well, it might be more typical of people of my generation, and people of my generation who were principal dancers functioning, for instance, in live television. In live television, we danced only on cement stages.
Mm-hmm.
The cameras in those days were so enormous that you couldn't have a wooden or soft floor. You had to have cement.
Wait. The cameras were so enormous that you needed Oh, of course. You needed the cement floor to support it.
To support the weight of those enormous instruments. Now, of course, the miniaturization in, of electronics has allowed these cameras to be much smaller. And you can put them on wooden floors and linoleum-covered wooden floors.
And you were known especially for your leaps and jumps, so you'd land hard, I guess.
The landings were the devastations. I broke 9 toes on cement in television in those early days. But I was also a person within the New York City Ballet who had the great fortune to dance most of that repertoire. And I would do 2, 3, 4 ballets a night. Also, I was at a time when there were not that many bravura male dancers, so I was called upon to do an awful lot of that stuff. Plus, I just loved dancing, and I found it hard to say no. I just danced everywhere and anywhere.
When you had your hip replacement surgery, was that still in its experimental stages, and were you worried about it? Were you warned against it at the time?
Well, when that occurred to me, there was I considered a very primitive operation, and I was told that it had a life expectancy of 16 years, and it was really designed for much older people. And I was 40 years old at the time, and I just didn't think that that was a good idea. And I said that to my doctor, and I said, I believe in medical science, and I'm going to wait this out. And he said, well, you may not be able to handle the pain because it's the equivalent, or so I was told, of a broken bone. So it was 24-hour pain, and for 5 1/4 years, I didn't sleep 2 hours back to back. But I decided I was just going to deal with that and wait for a new operation. After 4 years, a new operation occurred. I then said to my doctor, I would wait 1 more year and let them get version 2 of this operation, because anything new certainly is improved after a year's time. And I now have a version 2 of the operation I had 10 years ago. And I am very happy to say it still serves me very well. And don't tell my doctor, but I abuse it.
How do you abuse it?
Well, I jump up and down on it. You know, it's not the kind of thing that you should challenge. I mean, it allows you to walk and run and lead a normal life, but it really is not designed to be demonstrating entrechassis and double air tours and things like that. And I somehow can't help myself. I know I shouldn't do it, but it's what my life is about is moving, and I find it very difficult not to move. But at any rate, since that operation, there is now an even more contemporary one that is highly, highly successful.
But you wouldn't want to go through that again.
I would prefer not to.
Right. Edward Villela is my guest. I was just watching a clip of you performing on the Ed Sullivan Show. I'm not sure what year it's from, but I think we can assume it's from probably the early 60s or something. And so you do this fabulous dance. I'm not sure who the ballerina you were dancing with was. Then Sullivan comes out after the performance is over, and he says, beautiful dancing, Edward Villela, where are you from? And you say, Bayside, Long Island. And you laugh, and he laughs. And he asks the ballerina, where are you from? And she says, Teaneck, New Jersey. And everybody's hysterical. What's so funny about that?
I'm amused by it now myself. I think that in those early days, people expected you to be from France or Italy or the Soviet Union, or you couldn't be American, good heavens, to be a classical ballet dancer. I think people simply Europeanized in their minds the stereotypical person. So I think that was one of the first indications that we're unaccustomed to this. This is a very, very young art form in this country. And thank heavens for the New York City Ballet and George Balanchine and people like Jerome Robbins, who Americanized classicism. When Balanchine went with the New York City Ballet for the first time to the Soviet Union in 1962, some of the officials there said, well, welcome back to the land of classicism. And Balanchine said, no, classicism now lives in America. So we now have, lo these many years, a true American classicism, which is now international. It is the new classicism, which really is showing us the way.
So you no longer would be laughed at from being at Bayside.
No, I think it's not quite as amusing as it used to be.
Right. Now you were from an Italian-American family.
Yes.
Was that considered even more unusual?
Oh, extraordinarily. My father was somewhat taken aback by this whole thing. He really was a somewhat backward-looking Italian-American. And my mother was the forward-looking person. And you have to understand that it wasn't only that art and classicism and ballet were an oddity in any Italian family, but a young boy, that was a totally different and new concept. And as a matter of fact, I danced only because my sister was dancing.
Yes, this story is part of ballet folklore now, I think. Why don't you tell the story about how you started dancing?
Well, my mother was an orphan, and she loved to dance and never had the opportunity. So when she had a daughter, she thought that that was a way that she might vicariously touch this. And she used to take my sister off to a local ballet school in Queens. And I used to hang out in the streets and get into physical trouble. I was just a very physical kid. Until one day I got knocked unconscious by a baseball and dragged home by my friends unconscious. And my mother was away with my sister. And she said, from that time on, I needed to go to my sister's school because she couldn't trust me on the streets anymore. And there were 40 giggling girls, their mothers and me. And I was bored to tears, and I couldn't sit still. And then they started to jump. And I went in the back of the room and started to jump with them. And I disrupted the class, and the teacher said she would only allow me to stay if I joined. And I was humiliated, but I was made to do it. And then in 6 months' time, I began to love what this stuff was. I was very physical, and I did all of those sandlot athletics and so on. But this was so much beyond it. I mean, it had such depth, it had development, it had structure, it had form, it had music, it had a physical language that you could speak with your body, and all of that made a great deal of sense to me, and I loved it. I went for about 5 or 6 years till I was about 16. My sister quit. I was made to quit. My father decided I should go to a military school. I'm a graduate of
the... Make you a real man.
You're right. So I'm a graduate of the New York State Maritime College. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Marine Transportation.
Did you have to hide from your fellow students at the maritime school that you loved ballet and that you danced ballet?
No, because I was also a welterweight boxing champion.
So you could take care of them, right?
I could speak a physical language.
So your parents didn't want you to dance professionally?
No.
They put you into the maritime college. You were there for 4 years, and you got back into ballet afterwards. How did you get back in?
Well, in my last year, I decided, frustration aside, I needed to move forward and do what I wanted to do, and I started going into the city, to New York City, and started taking some classes. And after I got myself into some kind of shape, I presented myself to Balanchine, and he offered me a job. And when I graduated, I told my parents this, and they basically didn't speak to me for about a year. But I sent them tickets to our opening night of the second season that I was with in New York City Ballet, and they expected to find it difficult to find me in the back line. However, there were 4 ballets on that evening, and I had 3 principal roles. And at the end of the evening, they were standing in the wings in tears, and the 3 of us stood on the stage laughing, hugging, and crying. And from that time on, my father became a balletomane. He ran a trucking business in the garment center, so he didn't really have that aesthetic background to understand what I was doing. But from that time on, I mean, he used to hand my pictures out in the garment center in my reviews.
What was he initially so worried about in terms of a career in dance? Was it the difficulty of making a living in dance, or was it how was I going to explain to my friends that my son is a ballet dancer?
I think he was more practical, and he thought that at that time, in particular, it wasn't a good and easy living.
Yeah.
You know, the New York City Ballet maybe worked about 5 or 6 months 6 or 7 months a year at that time, and the salaries were not extraordinary. So it didn't make for a very, very bright financial future. So I think he was very concerned about that. He said, you know, you'll break an ankle, and then what do? You need an education. And I'm delighted he felt that way, and my mother felt that way.
So he was very concerned about how you'd make a living in dance. You've been described as one of the first American male ballet dancers to really make quite a living at dance. I mean, did you feel compelled to prove that you could do it, that was possible because of your parents' reaction?
Yeah, possibly. First of all, I thought we all worked very hard and we weren't paid very well. I also thought that other people, other than Americans, who were talented and wonderful, who might be compatible with us, were making so much more money than we. And I determined that was something I, for myself, but also for other dancers and for the entire American dance field, would try to raise the producers' financial appreciation of American dancers. So I started to do things like insist on Top of the Show, on the Ed Sullivan Show, or Kraft Music Hall, or Bell Telephone Hour, or any of those other things. I used to do a lot of symphony dates, and I would insist on being paid at a level commensurate with the number of people in the audience. I would dance with the Cleveland Symphony, and there would be 8,000 people out there, and a famous opera singer had been there the week before, and there were 4,000. And this opera singer was probably making 2 or 3 times what I was making. And at the intermission, they were inviting me back already. And I said, fine, but you must understand the economics of this now. And I just thought it was very important. I thought it was important that Americans started to appreciate the level of their own.
Edward Villela is my guest, and he was one of America's star dancers. He was a principal with the New York City Ballet and now is the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, which has been around just for 4 years. It's still one of the very new companies, but one of the top regional companies in the country. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Edward Villela is my guest, and he's now the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. You've also been credited with opening up the role of the male dancer in ballet. Were there certain frustrations that you felt when you started dancing in the role of partnering, which is what so many men have so often been consigned to in ballet?
I was a disastrous partner when I first started dancing, because I stopped when I was just about 16, which is the time when you learn how to partner.
Right, this is you stop to go to the Maritime College.
Right.
Yeah.
So I never had any partnering experience. And I was so incredibly naive and so full of this passion to dance. When I came back, I just threw myself into it, and I didn't think about the intricacies. I didn't think about the inside understanding of the musicalities, and et cetera. And I certainly didn't think about partnering. I thought, well, you just grab him, pick him up, and put him down. That's all you have to do. And I'm strong. I'm an athlete. I won my letters in baseball. I'm a boxing champion. That's all I have to do. I can get him up. And it unfortunately, for those ballerinas that I had to dance with in those first 3 years, I basically learned how to partner on them in front of 2,000 or 3,000 people a night. And it was terrible for those poor ladies.
What would they tell you after a performance?
Nothing. They'd be running away in tears.
Oh, gee.
It was awful. And I apologize to them publicly right now. I'm sorry.
So did that have to do with your developing jumps and leaps and bravura moves? Was that not partnering, but was that more of where you felt you fit in?
Well, you know, I had a natural ability to jump, Mm-hmm. I had a natural ability to do the pyrotechnical things. I was a very athletic kind of person, dancer, whatever. And the natural instinct is to do what you do best, and you go towards that. And it was devastating for me to understand that it wasn't just this bouncing up and down on a stage. There was much more to it. There was a whole artistry to everything, including partnering. And just a presence on stage and style and characterization and relationships and all of those things. So once I had gotten back, I thought, well, that's it. That's when you start to learn, is when the curtain goes up. And fortunately for me, it became another passion, and that was to learn stagecraft.
You danced for many years for Balanchine. You were a principal, a star of the New York City Ballet. But from what I understand, you never really got that close to him, as close as some of the other dancers did. Why not?
Well, it was not in my nature to pursue inner circle. That simply was not what I was or what I was about. The other part of it was that when I did come back, and I found after a year or two that I really didn't know what I was doing and that I was damaging my muscles and my muscle tones and I was creating injury, I needed something else. And I began to analyze the technique, and I began to analyze the Balanchinian approach to it. And I began to understand that it wasn't just me who was hurting and complaining about the Balanchine classes. Everybody would do it, but they wouldn't admit it to Balanchine.
What do you think was wrong with the Balanchine technique in his classes, in the way he taught?
There was nothing wrong in what he gave. It was how he gave it. He was impatient. He would sometimes give 12, 14, 16 minutes at the bar. A normal bar is 30 to 40 minutes. So there's a slower pace, there's a build. He wasn't interested in building. My assumption is that he thought everybody came warmed up to class, that you would work 20 or 30 minutes before you came to his class. And I tried that. But you see, we were dancing 8 times a week, and me in particular doing 3-4 ballets a night. It was very, very difficult to get to the studio half an hour early to prepare in the morning when you'd just gotten off stage at 11 o'clock the night before. It was physically impossible to do. And I knew it. I knew that there was going to be difficulty, but I knew it was the only way I could survive.
Edward Villela is my guest. He was a star of the New York City Ballet, one of the best-known American male ballet dancers. He's now the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, one of the most acclaimed of the regional ballet companies in the States. You were married in 1962. This has been described as almost a landmark event in the world of ballet because it helped dispel the notion that every male ballet dancer was a homosexual. how do you feel when people describe your marriage that way?
They just didn't know my marriage. Which was somewhat tumultuous and ended in divorce. I am since married a second time. Well, I certainly didn't get married to prove that not all male classical ballet dancers are homosexuals. A lot of that stuff, that I was an example for American male dancers and all of that, it sounds as though I was on a crusade. I really wasn't. I was more on a crusade for the art form, for the ability to progress this wonderful thing. I mean, I just loved it. I happened to be an athlete who also was a classical ballet dancer. I happened to be a New York American, a New York Italian American kid from the streets. I happened to be all of that, and it just fit with the emergence of American classical dancing that I was emerging, and I began to personify this new American way to function and to move. In addition to that, I was this guy who really liked women, and I was this guy who used to be a boxer and play baseball and had Sandlot experience and stuff like that. It just happened that way, and naturally, I became this curiosity. And the press would be fascinated with it. And it started to mushroom and just evolve and develop. And I'm very happy it did. I'm truly glad it did, because it started to humanize this art form. And I think some of my colleagues even today, and certainly some of those people in the late 50s and early 60s, had a different approach. There was a grandness about it. There was a posturing about it, and I thought it was important to dispel that. That was 19th century, and it was also European and Soviet. And we were Americans. We were Fred Astaire's. We were the new classicism.
You know, we had talked about how you were helping to show that Americans could be classical ballet dancers. In your company, the Miami City Ballet, I think about a third of the dancers are Hispanic. Is this the next frontier to prove that blacks and Hispanics and people from around the world are capable of dancing ballet?
You know, it's sort of silly when you analyze it and think about it. I mean, human beings are human beings.
Right.
And there are certain human beings, it doesn't matter where they are from, who have abilities and talents. And that's all we seek. We seek talent. And for us right now, from where we are positioned in Miami, there are a lot of Hispanics there, and Miami attracts a lot of Hispanics. So we use what's available, we use what's there, and we begin to find out that Argentina produces some wonderful dances. We found out that Venezuela produces some wonderful dances. Colombia produced some wonderful dancers. So we also have people from Europe, from Italy, from Germany, and we have an Australian. We also have a lot of Americans. I would like Americans who were born in America. And in a funny way, it's been more than interesting. I've been able to find dancers. I have two, possibly three things that I look for in a dancer. Number one is a quality of movement. And the second most important thing to me is if that quality of movement can then physicalize music. So those are the two things that I look for, and I think that those two things are talents, whereas a lot of my colleagues, other artistic directors, will be looking at full-blown technical ability. Now, my perception is that you can't teach talent, but you can teach technique to talent. So that's what I try to find. I try to find talented people who don't yet have a full technique, and I prefer to do it slower, to take 2 to 3 years to get this kind of Balanchinian sense of quickness and passing through balance and off-balance kind of stuff into them.
Edward Villela, he's the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, which begins its fifth season this September. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, character actor Dick Miller. During his first 5 years in Hollywood, he appeared in 35 Roger Corman films, including Bucket of Blood and Little Shop of Horrors. He's now appearing in Gremlins 2. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with Palestinian Mubarak Awad on trying to create a nonviolent resistance movement in Israel's occupied territories. Awad was expelled from Israel and now runs an international nonviolent center in Washington, D.C. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new reissues featuring violinist Joseph Sigeri. And if you're trying to learn French, take heart. The French government is implementing new spelling reforms designed to make French easier to learn. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg just got back from France, and he'll fill us in. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has voted to denounce Senator Dave Durenberger for financial misconduct. The Senate agreed to accept the Ethics Committee report that concluded that Durenberger knowingly and willfully violated Senate rules regarding outside limits on income. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The vote was 96-0, with Durenberger and his colleague from Minnesota, Senator Rudy Boschwitz, voting present. Durenberger himself decided to accept the committee's recommendation. He encouraged his colleagues to do the same. After the vote, he read a brief statement on the floor of the Senate, apologizing, as he has in the past, for his actions, and he promised to work harder and better over the next 4 years. The committee found that a book deal Durenberger made with a small Minnesota publisher violated Senate limits on outside speaking fees, and that he improperly claimed reimbursements for expenses he incurred while staying in a Minneapolis condominium that he partly owned. Along with the denouncement, Durenberger has been ordered to pay more than $120,000 in restitution. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Also in Washington, President Bush has won another veto battle as the House failed to override a bill that would require employers to provide up to 12 weeks off without pay to workers with new babies or family emergencies. The president has vetoed 13 bills, and so far Congress has not overridden any. Mr. Bush vetoed the bill last month after it passed the House with bipartisan support and passed the Senate on a voice vote. In South Africa today, police arrested a senior member of the African National Congress, hours after the ANC announced that talks with the government are still on course. NPR's John Madison has more from Johannesburg.
Mandela held a news conference to announce decisions of the ANC's National Executive Committee. He blamed the government for the role of the police in failing to perform policing functions in areas where violence broke out between the ANC and the rival Inkatha movement. He condemned the government for arresting ANC members in recent weeks, and he called for the immediate release of all political prisoners. But he said that the talks with the government that are scheduled for August 6th will go ahead, and he named the ANC's negotiating team. But about 7 hours later, a member of the ANC Executive Committee, who'd been in the meeting with Mandela yesterday, was arrested. He is Mac Maharaj, a 55-year-old former prisoner on Robben Island, who returned to South Africa from exile last month. Whatever the reason for his arrest, it will add new tension to the ANC's relationship with the government ahead of next month's talks. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 8 points to close at 2,930.94 on volume of some 164 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, trying to create a nonviolent Palestinian resistance movement, a talk with Mubarak Awad. But first, among the century's great violin players, the greatest, according to classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, is Joseph Sigeri. He was born in Budapest in 1892 and died in Switzerland at age 80. Very few of Sigeri's important recordings are currently available, but now the British label Pearl has issued two compact discs devoted to the concerto performances from the height of his career. Lloyd says they will make you hear old pieces with a fresh air.
If you thought you knew the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, If the last time you heard it was one time too many, then you need to hear the extraordinary recording that begins with the excerpt I just played. It was made in 1933, and I've never heard anything that approached it for beauty of tone and depth of feeling, or that was so charged with meaning. The violinist is Joseph Sighetti, and the conductor is Sir Thomas Beecham, who leads his own hand-picked virtuoso orchestra, the London Philharmonic, one of the very greatest orchestras in the history of orchestras. The British label Pearl has issued a compact disc that includes all three of Sighetti's concerto performances with Beecham, the Mendelssohn, Mozart's fourth concerto, and Prokofiev's first. These recordings, along with Sighetti's Brahms with Sir Hamilton Hardy and Beethoven with Bruno Walter on a second Pearl disc, and a couple of Bach concertos that are not yet on CD, are the greatest violin concerto performances ever recorded, period. Listen to how communicative Sighetti makes the slow movement of the Mozart. He never betrays the elegance of the classical style, yet what a revelation to hear how much that style still speaks to us. When Sighetti got older, he developed serious problems with bowing and intonation. But even then, the eloquence and humanity of his interpretations were in a class by themselves. But because technically he was an easy target in those later recordings, and so few of his earlier recordings are available, his reputation has dimmed. But the absolute sweetness and incredible variety of these Pearl reissues ought to restore him to his rightful preeminence. Here's Sighetti in Prokofiev's first violin concerto, a work he virtually single-handedly championed when other fiddlers thought it was too modern or too hard to play. In the bigger pieces, the Beethoven and the Brahms, Sighetti's sense of architecture and large-scale continuity without any sacrifice of nuance is even more impressive. I wish I had time to play a whole movement, but perhaps one example will convince you. Listen to the grace and wisdom he so effortlessly brings to the first movement of the Brahms. Thank you. Late-night TV buffs might actually get an occasional chance to see Sacchetti. He's one of the guest performers in a World War II film called Hollywood Canteen. Betty Davis introduces him, and he plays a delightful solo. Then he plays a duet with another important violinist, Jack Benny. How could an artist whose performances are so heartbreaking not also have a sense of humor?
Lloyd Schwartz reviewed two new Joseph Sacchetti reissues on the Pearl record label. This is Fresh Air. Mubarak Awad is a Palestinian who has tried to create a nonviolent resistance movement in Israel's occupied territories. In 1985, after spending 15 years in the U.S., he founded the Palestinian Center for the Study of Nonviolence in East Jerusalem. He drew up 120 methods of civil disobedience to protest the occupation. According to Israeli journalists Zev Schiff and Ahud Ya'ari, Awad was seen as a curiosity on the fringe of the Palestinian rebellion, until the early days of the Intifada, when his center's pamphlets became the hottest items in town, and the Unified Command adopted whole parts of his program. Israel expelled Awad in 1988. The government accused him of being an instigator of the Intifada. He was ordered to leave the country after his tourist visa expired. Awad had become an American citizen in 1978. Secretary of State George Shultz and U.S. Ambassador Thomas Pickering protested the deportation. Awad now lives in Washington, D.C., where he heads an organization called Nonviolence International. I asked him how he got interested in nonviolence as a means of opposition.
Well, I'm first a Christian individual who is an Arab, and I was raised by my mother, and my father died in the war of 1948. And my mother always insists that I should not have revenge. I would not live right. She told me that the one who killed your father never knew that he left me alone with seven children. And also I was so much influenced by two groups, group of Mennonites and Quakers who come to the Middle East not to convert us from, to become better Christians or to be Baptist or Methodists, but they start living with us and dealing with us with the situation that really affected me so much that, say, why for a fellow who come to the Middle East and leave America to live with us in this misery? But they want to share our misery, and I felt a compassion with that, so I felt of doing it myself.
Your father was killed in 1948. What were the circumstances of his death?
He was working like a first aid, and he was pulling an Israeli or a Jordanian or somebody who had been wounded to bring it to my mother, because my mother was nurse, and he was shot while doing that.
Were you uprooted from your home when you were young?
Yes, when I was 5 years old, I was living in the section which became Israel, so I have to leave everything and go to the old city of Jerusalem, which became part of Jordan. And then we live as refugees all our life.
Did you grow up with a lot of anger toward Israelis for displacing you?
Oh, yes. Anger and hate and frustration and also very much of disappointment of the situation that happened. And it's a lot of anger.
Do you still feel that anger and hatred?
No. And I think that's where it becomes necessary for Palestinians to meet Israelis, and then after meeting, for the Israelis to tell their own stories, and that they have been also in a suffering, and they went through hell themselves too, that I became also saying that, all right, that if you went with hell and suffering, don't do that hell and suffering for us. Is there a possibility that we could live together, or we could have each one his own state, that we could both exist rather than killing each other?
You spent a lot of time in Israeli prisons when you were growing up. What for?
Most of the time after the war of 67, because I was always very active telling Palestinians to close shops, not to eat any Israeli product, that we should not accept occupation, and don't fool from the Israeli community that they treat us nice. Their dream is to take the land, and that's what they did in 48. So I was, to the Israeli, I was a troublemaker and trying to make life miserable for them, and I was.
Were you ever violent in your protests against Israel before turning to nonviolence?
Oh, no, never. Never. Even when I was in high school, I refused to carry a gun, completely refused. And in all my activities have always been in nonviolent activities.
Can you give us an idea of what conditions were like in the occupied territories in East Jerusalem, where you lived? What the conditions were like that made you oppose Israel so strongly for occupying those territories?
Well, first, I'm a Palestinian. I'm an Arab. And to be occupied by someone who don't speak my language or who is not interested in my cause, it's a disaster. Most of the Arab countries, they got their independence. When we, as Palestinians, we tried to get our independence here, the Jews came and they divided Palestine, and the Palestinians have no nationality. Then, being a Palestinian also, you always are discriminated against in an Israeli society, in a Jewish society. If you want to have a permit, then you need to wait for at least 6 or 7 months to get a permit, even a permit for a driver license. If you want to build something, they would not allow you. If you want to travel, you have to take restriction. Even your license plate have to be different because you are a Palestinian. You are discriminating against you because you are a Palestinian. You are able to come anytime they put you in jail and in prison without any cause, and you could stay over there for 6 months. And so life have been really a misery on a daily basis. It's like a whole community, we became non-people, non-existence. And to change that is to say, hey, we cannot be ruled by anybody. We have to have a Palestinian state.
As a Christian Palestinian, were you in the minority of Palestinians?
Yes, as a Christian, I'm a minority, but I did not use the center as a Christian Palestinian. I became active in an activity of nonviolence as a Palestinian nationalist rather than a Palestinian Christian. Yet, because of my Christianity, I became nonviolent.
Did you feel that it would be divisive to make the center Christian-oriented?
If the center became a Christian-oriented center, we will not succeed at all. And my hope in that time that I will be able to convince even a Muslim that he will become a leader of a nonviolence movement, that he will start preaching it from the mosque, because of the majority of the people are Muslim, and that then nonviolence will be successful.
Can you give us an example of a technique or a tactic that you tried in the early days of Intifada that you thought caught on and was successful?
Many. One of the things which we try hard was when, like olive trees, when the Israeli soldiers will come and uproot olive trees to build a settlement, we will go over there and we either also some Palestinians and Israelis together, and we plant small olive tree seedlings so that the Israeli would not take the land. And we did that so many times. We also try to tell Palestinians it's not shameful to go to prison, that you have to be proud. And people start competing, villages from each other, saying, well, there is 200 people in prison from our village. The others say, oh, we pass by. We have 500 people in prison. So it becomes a competition that to be in prison, it's all right, it's acceptable, it's something good rather than something dirty or something unethical.
I think a lot of our listeners will be wondering how you, who preaches nonviolence, can feel comfortable working with the PLO, which has always been an organization that has advocated violence and what most people regard as acts of terrorism?
Well, the PLO is like a government. And for any listener to understand how I could talk to the PLO and work with the PLO, the same thing if anybody who believe in nonviolence or in peace working with the American government. Part of the organization is an armed struggle organization who believe in guns, or it's an army for them. So as a Palestinian myself, I do not see the PLO as a terrorist organization. I see it as a liberation organization, and part of the PLO who carry guns are part of an army that the PLO, they have that. Since they are not on their own land, they are in the exile, they are using all kind of methods which an army use. I mean, if Israel, for example, will go and hit in Lebanon, we don't call it terrorist because it's a government. Or if United States will go and hit Panama, it's a government. But if an organization will go and hit Panama or go and hit other people, this is terrorism. We don't see it. I don't see it as that. I see that the PLO is the only organization that the Palestinians we have. It has some good and some bad things. And it's up to us to make the changes within the PLO to make it, quote, perfect organization, where there is no perfect organization in the world.
What is your response when the PLO, when a group within the PLO blows up a bus of civilians?
I will come against it, and I will urge other Palestinians and even the PLO leaders that this is wrong, and this is not the way we have to do it. Then if they, and that's how we have to do it within, and to make the change within our society. And I am one of those who is so much supporter of the PLO, and for me, the changes that happen in the PLO are so marvelous changes that at least they are restraining themselves so much till now. It's an amazing thing that they are able to do it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Mubarak Awad heads Nonviolence International in Washington, D.C. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have reports on the Eastern Airlines indictments, also on the veto of the family leave bill sustained in the Congress. But also we'll have a report today on how women and men speak differently. We'll hear news of a big Japanese employer moving into the town that was the model for Thornton Wilder's play Our Town. And also remembering an event 25 years ago to this day, when it might have been the end of the Ice Age, or a millennial turning point. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
What are you talking about?
Well, you'll have to tune in later to find out.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg recently returned from a visit to France, where he was hardly the only one obsessed with language.
The French have a lot on their mind these days. What with the economic reorganization of Europe, the specter of German reunification, and the ominous rise of the extreme right in France itself. But in France this summer, the dominant topic of dinner conversation is none of these, but rather the spelling reforms that the government is about to put into place. The reforms affect maybe 100 words in all. They'll be dropping the I from the word for onion, for example, and the hyphens will disappear in a bunch of borrowed words like le cowboy, le pique-nique, and le striptease. But the most controversial reform is the almost total elimination of the circumflex, the little roof-shaped accent that goes over the vowel in words like tête and fenêtre. The rationale given for the changes is that they'll make the language easier to learn, not just for school children, but for foreigners, so that French will be more competitive on the world linguistic market as an alternative to English. To be sure, this is all slightly absurd. True, the circumflex is a pretty useless little mark, but getting rid of it doesn't go very far towards simplifying a spelling system that's rivaled only by English in its capriciousness. And in any case, nobody ever decided to study English instead of French on the grounds that English spelling is so rational.
Still, the orthographic circumcision stirs up a lot of controversy. The debate seems to offer a perfect occasion for airing all of the contradictions that define the French psyche. It pits tradition against reason, culture against commerce, nationalism against internationalism. To hear the traditionalists tell it, the reformers are selling out the language of Hugo and Rimbaud in the first step down the road to the collapse of French civilization. Actually, French critics rarely use the phrase French civilization, they just say civilization. Whereas the modernists see the circumflex as a kind of Maginot line in reverse, which stands between France and the role she's destined to assume in the new Europe. The reforms were announced by Prime Minister Michel Rocard following the recommendations of a special High Commission on the French language, with a consultation of the French Academy. Beginning in 1991, the new spellings will be taught in all schools and used in all textbooks. To appreciate just how French all this is, you have to imagine George Bush calling a press conference to announce that on the recommendation of a special presidential panel on the American language, it will now be I before E, even after C. But the French expect the state to take responsibility for the language. The National Assembly passes laws to limit the broadcast time that can be given to English language pop songs, and half the Foreign Service budget goes to promote the use of French abroad. Language is what defines them, after all. Theodore Zeldin once remarked that if you force the French to striptease, discarding one by one all the outward disguises that give them their national identity, the last thing left to them would be their language. It's easy to make fun of this exaggerated solicitude, but then the French are bemused by our idea of national identity with its fetishization of a particular political system. After all, they have managed to keep the subjunctive alive under four monarchies, one empire, three revolutions, five republics, an occupation, and at least two flags. Granted, it's strange to us that they should have a minister of culture, but it's no less puzzling to them that we should be debating a flag-burning amendment or that we once had a House committee on un-American activities. If there are un-French activities, after all, they're more on the order of putting ketchup on your creme caramel or getting the gender of a word wrong. Every nation has its characteristic silliness. It's just that the French are a little more practique about theirs.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Dan Buskirk and Lisa McCullough. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
I put a spell on you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Dick Miller tells us about making Little Shop of Horrors, Bucket of Blood, and dozens of other Roger Corman films. And we talk with Michael Almereyda about directing Crispin Glover and Harry Dean Stanton in the new film Twister, the story of a family of eccentrics. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.